ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, when you think of bushrangers, the image that often springs to mind, of course, is probably one of a dirty, bearded white man on a horse brandishing a shotgun. And the legendary names, Ned Kelly, of course, Ben Hall, Captain Thunderbolt, Captain Moonlight, Moondye Joe. But this stereotypical picture doesn't quite tell the full story. Historian Meg Foster has been researching a host of other lawbreakers of Australian colonial history to tell the stories of the likes of Sam Poo, known as Australia's only bushranger of Chinese heritage, and the African-American criminal called Black Douglas, and Indigenous bushrangers, including Mary Ann Bug. They ought to make a movie of her life, I tell you. Captain Thunderbolt's partner, Mary Ann Bug. Partner equal, I would have thought, in many ways, too. Jimmy Governor, regarded by many as a, well, he probably was, a mass murderer. Her book, Boundary Crossers, the Hidden History of Australia's Other Bushrangers, was published to great acclaim last year. But since then, of course, she's gone to Britain to further research the historical links and parallels between Australia's bushrangers and England's highwaymen. Dr. Meg Foster's an historian and these days is holed up at Newnham College at Cambridge University. But luckily for us, she's live on the line from the UK. Meg, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's terrific to have you with us. Let's start with why you wrote the book about bushrangers called Boundary Crossers. When did you realise there was more to Australia's bushrangers than Ned Kelly and Captain Thunderbolt?
Well, I'd always been interested in history, and particularly where history really enmeshes in our daily lives, where it intersects with how we actually go about our days. And I was speaking to a mentor at Sydney Uni about this, and he was like, oh, you know what, why don't you do something on Aboriginal bushrangers? That hasn't really been done before. And I was like, oh, shocked. I'd taken every Australian history course, every Indigenous history course, and thought I was quite across that history, but I'd never heard of an Aboriginal bushranger before. And from there, I realised that there were other bushrangers as well. As you mentioned, Sam Poo, Chinese bushranger, African-American man named Black Douglas. And my question then became, well, why don't we know about these people? Why don't we know their stories? Why aren't they, you know, celebrated on a national stage in the same way that we know Ned Kelly? And that's really how the book came to unfold, trying to see who were these people and why didn't we already know about them?
Yeah, I know. It gets back to this story again and again, doesn't it, Meg? I mean, what we were told about our own history is so woefully inadequate, wasn't it? And the great stories that are there but that aren't told, we're fed a diet of Ned Kelly endlessly, ad infinitum, as though that was the only thing that ever happened. The image of the dirty, gunslinging white man, how close was that to reality anyway?
I mean, the answer is more complex than you'd think. So in terms of, I mean, dirty, take the first thing that you mentioned. Elite bushrangers, so the really prolific ones who had long careers and really tried to garner a lot of public support, they'd often dress quite flamboyantly and try to actually maintain their physical appearance to actually be more striking and to try to get that support. But of course, on the ground, most bushrangers were not elite bushrangers. They were very opportunistic. They'd see a chance to rob someone either on the road or sometimes even burgle their houses. They'd take it and then they'd often go back to their regular lives if they weren't caught. And so I think it's important at the very beginning of our conversation to really make this distinction between the elite mythic bushranger, which are the ones that we've remembered and are a part of our culture, versus the criminal everyday bushranger who make up the vast majority of people who actually committed these types of crimes.
Mm. Let's talk about some of them. Let's talk about Black Douglas. What's the story about Black Douglas that was received by the public? What do we know about him?
Yeah, so Black Douglas is infamous in the 1850s on the gold rush of Victoria. Mm-hmm. He's renowned as a bushranger. He's meant to have stolen from diggers gold and other types of goods. He's also meant to have murdered a white woman at a goldfield called Avoca. And that really incites a lot of hate and furor towards him. And there's actually a near lynching. So in 1855, a gang of diggers hear this story of this murder and they decide, you know, enough is enough. We need to put a stop to this infamous criminal, and they capture him. They fight with picks and shovels against Douglas and his gang. They capture him, put him in a cart, bind him, and there's, yeah, a move to actually lynch him, which was quite spectacular at the time. I mean, in America on the goldfields, lynching was not unheard of, and the idea was that there needed to be mob justice because otherwise there'd just be lawlessness. Mm. But in Australia, we always like to pride ourselves on, you know, following Her Majesty's or His Majesty's justice, whoever was in charge at the time. And so this move to lynch was actually quite spectacular. Luckily, one lone policeman was able to talk the citizens down, and they actually took Douglas to a nearby town called Maryborough instead, where he was given over to the authorities. But that is the received wisdom about who Douglas was in kind of a nutshell. He was this infamous, dastardly criminal who robbed on the goldfields and murdered this white woman. But of course, there's more to the story than
Tell me about what you found about the story.
Yeah, well, I mean, my instinct as an historian is not to take any of this for gospel, to try to unpick it, to try to see, well, what are these truth claims and how can we back them up? And the answer is Douglas was never convicted for any heinous crimes. So he was never convicted for murder. He was never convicted for even highway robbery. It was mainly alcohol-related offences on the goldfields he was most often before the court for. Mm-hmm. And so my question then became, okay, well, you know, did he commit this murder of this white woman at Avoca? And why did these stories gain such purchase and have such reach if they were in fact fabricated, if they were just stories? So this murder of this white woman was not committed by Douglas. We have very intimate details of the assailants, and there were five men on horses, and they were described right down in granular detail. So you had the colour of the muzzle of their horses, but none of these criminals were black. So it was clearly not the man that we're looking for.
So it was just old-fashioned racism on the goldfields, was it?
I mean, race is certainly a part of it, yeah. And I mean, to go to your question of like, who was Douglas, goldfields miners, they didn't care who he was. They didn't care about his backstory. He was a symbol to them. He symbolized racial disorder on the goldfields, which when you think about it, white gold miners needed stories to make sense of the world, which was so constantly shifting around them. On the goldfields, anyone could strike it rich. It didn't matter if you were an African-American man, if you were Maori, if you were Aboriginal. These people who had previously been thought of as in the like lowest rungs of the racial hierarchy, to use colonial logic, if you can call it that, were suddenly plunged into these stories of success and were equals in terms of opportunities on the goldfields. And that really confronted a lot of white miners, whereas it was so reassuring to them in this story of Douglas as a dastardly criminal and murderer of a white woman. You had a clear villain, you had a clear victim, and it really righted their sense of what race and gender should be at the time. And so that, I believe, is why this story had such currency and had such purchase.
Mm. Yeah, the story of Ned Kelly's always bothered me a lot, I must say, because he's, you know, he's been erected almost in heroic stance in comparison to somebody like Black Douglas, even though Ned Kelly was just really a common criminal, wasn't he? Why? What is it? Is it race that explains both of these things, do you think?
It definitely plays a part of it, but in the case of Ned Kelly, it is quite complex. So now historians are looking back even at the time and saying, did Ned and his gang have the support we think he did? Mm. And once again, the story is a bit more complicated. So there's some evidence that actually Ned and his family were renowned as kind of local bullies who were kind of trying to get people in the area to fall in line with them. There are some allegations of, I guess, tyranny under their rule, if you can call it that. But I think the thing with Ned and why he's become a particular icon is actually to do with nationhood, is to do with Federation in 1901. The colonies are all coming together. They're looking for symbols for the new Australian nation. Mm-hmm. And the bushranger is there. It provides a really handy, easily identifiable symbol that is masculine, which is important.
Anti-authoritarian.
Exactly. Oh, I mean, I guess that that wasn't quite the angle a lot of people were going for. Because,
okay.
I mean, there's the sense that more than anti-authoritarian, bushrangers are able to survive in the elements and make the bush their home. They're able to use it to survive on the run from the law. And that naturalizes a white settler presence. It makes it seem obvious and like it's been an earned position that there are white people in what we now call Australia. And that really helps to distract everyone from the fact that there were First Nations people in the Australian colonies for tens of thousands of years before the First Fleet in 1788. And so people like Ned Kelly, they're white, which is very important, and they're this masculine, rough frontier ideal that kind of is meant to epitomize the type of citizen that the new Australian nation is behind. And later, that anti-authoritarianism is also important, but that in over time also gets institutionalized, which is another quite interesting thing about bushrangers. From being lower working class symbols, you know, we had in Sydney 2000, the Olympic Games, Ned Kelly's were all over the opening ceremony. So the government is now even recognizing that bushrangers are symbols. And I find that transition from, you know, folk heroes among the common people to recognize government ordained national symbols of our country, quite an interesting transition in itself.
Yes, Michelle has texted. This is how things take off, you see. Michelle says, ah, yes, Philip, but the Girildry letter, it's a masterpiece. Well, I don't think so. What do you think about the Girildry letter, which there's no real evidence that Ned Kelly ever wrote anyway, is there?
That's another sticky question. There are obviously, I mean, some historians think that one of his gang is actually the writer at the very least, that Ned may have dictated the letter. It is an important letter, I would definitely say that. And I think it touches on some well-worn bushranging themes and also outlaw themes as well, your Robin Hood-esque themes. So, you know, fighting against tyranny, fighting injustice from the authorities, the need to redistribute wealth equally or at least fairly and justly. But it isn't an odd letter as well. And I think it's important to note that Ned wasn't the only one to leave letters. So if we had a look at someone like Jimmy Governor, who I write about in my book, he's actually inspired by Ned Kelly himself. He's operating in 1900. He's been reading serialized versions about the Kelly gang, and he actually leaves his own letters to the police outlining his grievances and why he believes he's taken to bushranging. But as you implied in the opening, he's renowned as a mass murderer, not as a bushranger.
Because he was what, Aboriginal?
Yeah, I think that's a really big part of it. So obviously Ned Kelly is also a murderer. He killed police officers, he intended to kill more when he attempted to derail the train going into Glenrowan, and that train contained civilians as well as police. So murder itself is not enough to stop someone from being a bushranging hero, or at least remembered in our national culture. But race is really important. And you've got someone like Jimmy Governor, who in that exact moment I mentioned before, when Australia's looking for national symbols and it's trying to use the bushranger to symbolise this great, valiant white man trope, here comes an Aboriginal man claiming that title for himself. That's so disruptive. And that is also disruptive in terms of chronology, because we often think of Ned Kelly as the last bushranger, and he was executed in 1880. And here we have Jimmy Governor, an Aboriginal man, operating in 1900. And they actually delay his execution until after Federation celebrations are over in 1901, because they don't want his execution to taint those celebrations. So there's a very clear awareness of Jimmy Governor and his case being super disruptive to that idea of triumphant white nationalism that the new Australian nation really wanted to get behind in 1901.
It's interesting, isn't it? Dr. Meg Foster's with us, an historian, has written a very interesting book called Boundary Crosses about the hidden history of Australia's other bushrangers. Speaking of Aboriginal bushrangers, there should be a movie about Mary Ann Bugg, shouldn't there?
Oh, I completely agree. Sign me up. I'd like to
I don't understand
it.
Why no one's
listening?
Made a movie about Marianne Bugg. Seriously, this is a terrific story, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. I mean, I probably shouldn't have a favorite out of the people in my book, but Marianne is certainly up there. She's just such a larger-than-life character. She's such a badass. She really defies a lot of expectations and is incredibly savvy when it comes to figuring out who her audience is and what she needs to do to survive.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, sure. So Marianne Bugg was the daughter of a Worimi Aboriginal woman from the Gloucester area of New South Wales and a white convict who was part of the Australian Agricultural Company. And she really hits the historical record hard in the 1860s when she becomes the partner of Captain Thunderbolt, who you mentioned before. Mm. And till now, that's really been the way she's remembered, as kind of Thunderbolt's partner, his helpmate, his kind of loyal Aboriginal woman. But she's the protagonist in her own story. She's incredibly resilient. She is on the run with Thunderbolt. There's clear evidence that she was actually likely involved in the crimes he committed as well. She had a real awareness of what was going on. She'd spread misinformation as well, say that they were going to one area, whereas they'd go to another. In one instance, she and her children, who are also on the run.
And she had stacks of children too.
Yes, she did. But in the instance I'm talking about, she was there with two of her children and heavily pregnant at the time. And she and children were caught by the police, who were in search for Thunderbolt, who wasn't there. And she berates the police. She calls them cowards for trying to capture her instead of Thunderbolt. She's meant to have challenged one to single combat. And once they get her on a horse, she actually leaps off and rips an officer's shirt to ribbons. And so eventually they bring her and the children away, but she has another trick up her sleeve and she claims to be going into labor. So she says, oh, my contractions have started. You need to let me go. So they actually leave her at a nearby station where she's meant to give birth. But lo and behold, as soon as the police leave, she swiftly escapes with Thunderbolt and the kids. So that type of story just really epitomizes what an incredibly strong, ingenious, amazing character that she really is.
She certainly was. Yes, no, there is more to our history than we have been told. And I'm glad you're digging and telling it maybe like it is. You've been digging into highwaymen, by the way, just briefly before you go, in Britain. Were they the sort of bushrangers of their time, were they?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in a highwayman in part because it's been assumed that that's where bushranging came from. Mm. So a lot of historians, especially in like the 1950s, were writing saying, you know, convicts came from Britain, they brought traditions of highway robbery, and well, it just seamlessly became bushranging. But my research shows it's actually a lot more complicated than that. There are definitely some cultural traditions that continue. So the idea of, you know, the honourable, chivalric, gallant highwayman does transfer to some of the elite bushrangers I mentioned before. But there are also huge differences. So in Australia, frontier warfare really affects the nature of bushranging and bushranging crimes. Aboriginal people are a huge part of the development of bushranging as a specific type of crime. Piracy is another element of Australian bushranging that hasn't really been looked at before. It wasn't just a land-based activity. Banditry moved between terrestrial and maritime spaces. So there's also the convict context as well. So there's a lot more going on than I think that assumed cultural inheritance from highwaymen really lets on.
Mm. Interesting. Looking forward to the rest, to more of your work. Meg, terrific to have your time too. And well done. Good luck in digging up more at Cambridge University.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful to be on the show.
Good on you. Dr. Meg Foster, who is busy rewriting our great story. This thing is, these stories are great stories, even when you start telling the truth about them, I think, which is why I think it's so fascinating. Dr. Meg Foster.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.